Welcome to another episode of Inside the Lens podcast. In this one, episode 6, I talk to Martin Bailey, who is a phenomenal photographer, an excellent human being, and an all-around nice guy. He is also an avid printer. He's enthusiastic about it. He's incredibly knowledgeable about printing and all of the aspects of getting the right color, choosing the right materials. And so we have a great discussion about all of those things over the next hour. Enjoy. I'm sitting down today with a friend and colleague and a fellow X-Rite Colorati here, Martin Bailey. And Martin, you and I go back quite a ways. We both guest host on TWIP, and you've had me conveniently on your podcast in the past to talk about printing and all sorts of geekery. It was a blast. You do so many fun things, photographically speaking, and we're going to touch on that a lot today. Martin, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Don. It's great to be here. Congratulations on getting your own podcasts kicked off.
Thank you.
By the time people listen to this, at least it will be.
Yes, yes. Well, it's funny because I've had this idea in the works for way too long. Yeah. And it's going to be interesting to see how I can fill up the weeks because this is a very technical and very geeky podcast.
Yeah.
But at the same time, how many of those topics are there? So thankfully, we can dive deeply into many different directions in them. And we're here, I think, well, who knows where the conversation is going to go, but I'm intending to talk about printing. And I know very few photographers actually print their own work anymore. And so when I was trying to think of somebody that actually did and kind of enjoys that side of the art form, your name was the first name that came to mind.
Thanks.
How long have you been printing?
Probably my first inkjet printer, and this is, I'm not talking about fine art printing at this point, but my first inkjet printer was probably 1994 or five. And I did print a few photographs back then, but the technology wasn't really allowing us to print really true, beautiful photographic prints. It was nothing like it is now. I got my first printer that could actually make, I think it was A3 plus, so 13 by 19. Got that in, will have been about 2002, I think. So 14 years ago when I started making fine art prints, but I got my first large format printer, which really took it to the next level, exactly 6 years ago. And it's sitting behind me broken at the moment.
Oh, no. I can see it. That looks like a Canon Image Pro Graph, probably by the size, like a 6000 series.
It's 6350, exactly.
Right.
So, yeah, it was the current model 6 years ago when I bought it. But I started to look into using a rip for my printing, just really because I want to know more about rips.
Okay, well, what is a rip?
Well, it's basically, I've only just started looking into it, and the printer broke as I sent the first print to it. But I've been using a piece of software for the Mac called Color Burst Overdrive. And it really, what it does, I mean, it takes the profile that I'm using, and you can either drop images into the, once it's set up with your borders and everything, I can either drop the photos directly into a hot folder, just export them from Lightroom or whatever I'm working in, drop the image into a drop folder, and it will just throw it straight at the printer in literally less than, I don't know, 3 or 4 seconds. And it just makes the whole thing very, very efficient. And so it's more for people that, say if I'm working in a printing house and I've got multiple people working, preparing prints, sending them to printers. You can just do it much more efficiently. And I'm not sure at this point, I haven't actually evaluated the results. I don't know if there's any difference in the quality, because I've always been happy with the quality of the prints that I'm getting from Lightroom. So I don't know at this point if it's going to improve the quality, but it probably is going to improve the efficiency.
Yeah, well, and I know that's one of the main reasons why a lot of larger print houses use a RIP, or as we should explain what the acronym stands for, a raster image processor.
Yeah.
That takes the actual pixel data of the image and processes that into information on which inks should go exactly where that pixel would otherwise be, and how you can translate an image that is not necessarily the same pixels per inch as the dots per inch in the printer. It's got to do a lot of math and a lot of calculations to figure all of this out. Especially, you know, the printer that you and I both have, Martin, it's got 12 ink tanks.
Right.
And with that many choices for which color, it's not like you've got a combination of red, green, and blue. Mm. Interestingly, those are three of the colored inks, but you can't mix them the same way on a print as you would to emit from a screen. It's entirely different technology, right?
Plus, it's got the cyan, magenta, yellow, magenta, and black, and all of the other colors
CMYK,
as well.
CMYK, so cyan, magenta, yellow, black, and RGB. So then we're up to seven there. And then you've got usually a photo black, which is a different quality of black, typically for glossy prints. Mm. Then you've got a gray, a photo gray, a photo cyan, and a photo magenta.
Exactly.
And that brings you all the way up to 12.
Yeah.
And some of them will even have like a gloss
that
kind of goes on top.
Yeah.
Because one of the issues is, let's say you've got some heavy ink content in one part of your image, but a light ink content in the other part. Well, then the heavy ink content will take on the gloss of the ink. The light ink content will take on the gloss or the matte of the paper. And if you look at it on extreme angles, you will see a slight difference between the two.
And so sometimes
bronzing is a shifting of the color, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
I thought it was to do with the reflectivity as well. But
anyhow, we're throwing out all sorts of crazy terms here. And it's funny because these rabbit holes go way deep. But I want to dial it back, Martin, to your first experiences with printing.
Okay.
Because when I was, just digging through old, family photo albums and what have you, you've got the old, stuff made from like optically exposed negatives and those old black and white prints, which actually scan really, really well, especially the smaller ones. The DPI, the resolution of those prints is far and above sometimes what we can even do digitally today. Mm. And then we get into like this wasteland of prints that were produced in that era. You said like mid-90s to, maybe even the early 2000s, where the printing technology digitally was just so bad. Mm. And there's like, we had a desktop printer and my dad was an early adopter of digital photography and he thought it was just the cat's meow to take a picture and then print it digitally. Those were so terrible. Like the images themselves were not bad. It was like from a Kodak 1-megapixel camera. And there's only so much you can do with that.
Yeah.
But man, those prints, I look at them now, it's like I can't do anything with them anymore. It's just they're faded, they're destroyed. The paper was terrible to begin with.
Yeah.
And so the cycle starts as to how we start to develop good printing tech. And I think that within the last decade is when it's really been viable for photographers without having like a scientific degree in printing or an apprenticeship in the art form can pick up the necessary tools and kind of dive in successfully with some experimentation. Of course, that costs you money. And so you have to embrace that. But it's a far easier thing to do now than I think it ever has been, especially with all the calibration tools and stuff like that on the market that just simplify the process considerably. So your first prints, do you still have any of them, or did you just look at them and say no, that's just
the first ones that I made? I believe the first printer that I said that the output I believed was could be easily called fine art was an old Epson. I think it was a PM4000PX or something like that. I'm not sure if that was the same number used in the US or Canada or wherever, everywhere else in the world. I do have some of those prints. I've got them. I've actually probably still got some in an old large clamshell box, a 13x19. I haven't got them out in a long while, but I do have prints from that. They were good quality, and at that time as well, we started to see the fine art paper come out, I was using a beautiful mat. I think it was their Velvet Pro or something. You know, stick a Pro on the end and everyone buys it. But I can't remember the exact name, but it was a really beautiful, smooth velvet fine art paper. And I mean, I've got no worries at all about the longevity, especially if they're sitting in a clam box. So there's going to be no problem there. It would be interesting to pull some out and see what they look like, just to see the quality. I actually, even on my blog, I've got some, because shortly after I started podcasting, I bought the Canon, which one was it? One of the earlier Canon A3 Plus printers. And I did some comparisons because I wanted to know, you know, I was happy that, you know, Canon printers are relatively cheap, or have been, but they've got different qualities. I find that the and I found this basically from my earliest tests, but I found that the Epson printer was much more analog. The results looked more like a photograph. If you look at them with a quite strong lupe, you get the you can see very fine gradations, and this is comparing my old Epson with my old Canon. But you got this really beautiful fine gradations, and the dots were in, you know, arranged in such a way that it looked more like looking into a matte print that was done with traditional methods. But the Canon was much more digital. It was sharper. There were certain areas that looked better, but it was much more sort of crunchy. It was more of like an engineer's print than an artist's print initially. But then I moved to the IPF 6350, and it all changed again. But yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, I own the same printer as you, except I had the 6300, which did not have the built-in hard drive.
Yeah.
That was,
yeah,
I think, the only difference between the two of them.
That's all the only difference.
I've since replaced it. I've now got the 8400, because our old printers were 24-inch printers. Mm. And they're not that expensive, to be honest. No, when I was looking into repairing it, I realized it would cost me less to buy a new one than it would be to replace this one, because it was giving me an error saying that the voltage on the printheads was inaccurate or something like that.
You know what? That is exactly what I've got right now.
So then I look into it further and I think, okay, well, that means that the main board needs to be replaced. It's like, okay, well, that's great, because that's out of warranty. And then it continued to print for another couple of days, maybe a week at most.
Exactly. Well, that's
and then it was giving me printhead errors. And I'm like, okay, well, that means that it's fried the printheads. Both printheads and the main board need to be replaced. I'm going to buy a new one. And
you know what? That's exactly what's happened to me. 2 weeks ago, I had a print order that came in and I tried to print it and I got the error. I unplugged it, plugged it back in, got it again, unplugged it, plugged it back in, and it worked. And I was able to print the print job to send to ship to my customer. But then when I started to look into this rip again last week, it just, the same thing happened. And I thought, oh, great. So we're, you know, and I had Canon, the engineer came here on, I think it was Tuesday afternoon. And he said, okay, so the course of action is change both print heads. That's going to cost you $900. $800. He said, during that process, you're probably going to run out your maintenance cartridge. So that's another couple of $100. It's got a 50% chance of fixing the issue. And if it doesn't, the next thing is the controller board. So he said, you're going to be looking at the cost of the printer by the time you finished. So what do you want to do? So I'm like, okay, well, what do I do? I've asked him to, because we live in a three-story apartment, and these things weigh a lot. I didn't buy the 8400 when I moved here because it was too heavy. It's like 100K.
Well, when it was delivered, like two men had to carry it downstairs, partly disassembled, and then reassemble it in place. And like, it's not something that I could have done myself.
Well, so that means you've got it in the basement, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I'm on the third floor. My studio here is on the third floor of a wooden structure. So I really can't have, well, this is what I'm asking them at the moment, because what's happening is, the next version of this printer that came out was the IPF 6450 or 6400 without the hard drive. And I have that's roughly the same machine. It's just a slightly newer generation, but it's just been replaced. The IPF 2000 is just coming out, and it's a beast. It's the same, even at the same 24-inch roll size, it's 100 kilometers. It's 100 kilograms. So, you know, the printer itself is 1.5 times heavier than the original. So I've got them at the moment trying to figure out if I can actually put it in my studio on the third floor. I mean, you think about it, it only weighs as much as me. I mean, I weigh about 20 kilograms more than I should.
True. And if you're standing on 1 foot, your weight is in a tiny little point. You know, it's not very evenly distributed, and you're not breaking through the floor. So,
yeah. So the thing is I probably can have it installed, but the availability at the moment, I don't want to buy a 6450 at the moment if there's a new 2000 on the market, but the weight is definitely a concern for me.
True. And so when they delivered this, like, thankfully it's in the basement, and we just bought this house. We don't plan on moving for a very long time. And that printer is going to live its entire life in this house. I'm not going to move it. It's it's going to be picked up by e-waste people or whatever when we're out of here, because it's a beast. It's a behemoth, but it's a 44-inch printer.
Exactly.
And so I've done some images. The biggest I've printed on that was a 70 by 40 on canvas.
Nice.
And it fills a wall. And there is something special about looking at your work when it's just filling up an entire wall, top to bottom, and it's just like you take a step back and you say, okay, well, now that print, that image is done. You know, it's not done until it's really printed, and a lot of people can enjoy it in many different ways. But I'm a firm believer that if you've got that perfect image, that, you know, it deserves some wall space.
I couldn't agree more. I think it's actually, it's almost like the print is the conception, not the print, the actual exposure is the conception, and then you've got this whole gestation period on your computer. But until it's actually made into a physical artifact, a physical thing, it's not really born. It's as though you've got all of the rest. And this, of course, is probably making you want to think about your new daughter at the moment. But
you know what, though? Because when my dad got that first digital camera, he didn't have a backup strategy. I mean, nobody knew what data management was in a household of that era. We lost all of those digital prints. They disappeared into the ether when computers were upgraded and things were forgotten. And but I still have those terrible, terrible prints that were made. the prints will survive that. So,
brilliant.
Speaking of prints and printmaking, I'd like to mention and thank the sponsor of this episode of Inside the Lens, Outdoor Photography Canada magazine. If you like the content of this podcast, then you'd probably also like my column in every issue of this magazine called Pushing Limits. And it's one of the few print publications that I recommend reading. I think what sets Outdoor Photography Canada apart from other photographic magazines is really the quality of the content. Well, it's produced by Canadians. I think photography is a universal art that that really knows no borders, and I think that anybody can explore this magazine. And my fellow contributors are top-notch. They cover relevant content. It's interesting. It's thought-provoking. And I think that there's a rare balance between great writing, excellent images, and of course the necessary advertisements that come in magazines like this, but it really has a lot of content for everybody to enjoy. And if you haven't picked up a copy of Outdoor Photography Canada, now's the perfect time, because I'd like to give you a special coupon code. Useful to anyone in Canada and the United States on 1-2 year subscriptions. Just use the code ITL on checkout and you'll get 20% off the regular subscription price. Head over to outdoorphotographycanada.com, or actually the shorter version is opcmag.com, opcmag.com, and use the code ITL and explore this excellent quarterly magazine. I'd like to thank again Outdoor Photography Canada for supporting this podcast, and I hope that you'll use that code and stay inspired and learn more about photography on every level. So, moving forward to, you'd mentioned something earlier on about the different types of papers and the experience that can provide. I've got rolls and rolls of some papers that I liked and I've bought more of, some that I didn't, and now they're just collecting dust. But man, that is a creative endeavor. You know, just the same as choosing which lens you're going to use to take the picture.
It is. Yeah.
Choosing which paper that you use down the road is going to be a fun bit too. And you don't have much of a choice if you're letting another lab do it. They might give you two or three options.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of companies out there, and each company that produces papers and canvases and what have you, they've got like 30 or 40 different products in their lineup in all sorts of different sizes. I'm partial to Hanamuel's Barita papers, which are like all cotton, and they have a really nice finish to them. Breathing Color makes some very, very nice canvas, and I know that you've used their canvases as well. In fact, I've used some of their Luster photo paper recently too. And then there's metallic printing and even metallic canvas.
You know, metallic canvas is off the charts. I've got a photo to my right here on the wall of Landmannalaugar in Iceland, and it's done on Breathing Colors Silverada metallic canvas, and it's just the dynamic range, you know, the amount, the range of colors and the depth, and you know, the deepest to the brightest color that you can print on this canvas is incredible. When you soft proof it, you can have the gamut warnings all over the screen for one photo. Switch the profile to this Silverada and they all just disappear.
Okay, let's touch on soft proofing then. Because what you see on your computer screen can never be what a printer outputs. They can be close, but this soft proofing process, which you can do very easily in Lightroom, there's a little checkbox for soft proofing. Correct me if I'm wrong, because I haven't used it that much. What this does is it will allow you to load up the printer paper profile. That say if you've calibrated it, and so that you've got the ICC profile on your computer, the calibrator knows what colors that printer on that paper is capable of producing and which ones it is not capable of producing. That's the gamut overall. And just like on a regular picture, when you're trying to see where your highlights and your shadows are clipped, then you can see gamut clipping, where it will alert you in red, I believe, what colors that you're currently seeing on the screen cannot be accurately reproduced on the print. And this is useful because if you can see that, then you can control how you can shift those colors around so that you can reliably now find a comparison between what the printer will do versus what you're seeing on the screen, instead of it just like kind of guessing what the nearest neighbor color or brightness is going to be and just doing that, and you have no control over it. Is that accurate?
It is. The thing that I thought we could add to that as you spoke there was that it also, the profile also has paper color information. It knows the quality of the surface of the paper. So there's a checkbox in Lightroom as well where you can simulate paper. I don't know if it's called just simulate paper. Simulate paper and ink, I think it says. And if you check that on, the image changes again because it's actually showing you what the profile knows about the paper and the quality of the inks.
Right. And it's not going to show you if you're using a watercolor paper. It's not going to apply that texture to it. But
no,
it would.
But the look, the reflectivity and everything.
Especially if you're using a matte paper, right, versus a glossy
exactly.
paper. It will emulate the kind of blacks that a matte paper is going to produce, which are duller than the deep blacks on a glossy paper. And really
it also
helpful to see
it also knows about the color of the paper as well, though.
I've got, I was just calibrating this with some of the Hanamuel stuff that I was just doing some prints on earlier, and it is a slightly warm color.
Yeah.
You know, I don't use this for everything, but I love it for my landscape imagery. So when I was dealing with that, the interesting thing is, and I know we're not recording the video here, Martin, but you might get a fun kick out of this. This standard test chart from an X-Rite Color Monkey made me scratch my head because I should not have three white patches. They should look a little bit more like this, where some of these patches are pink or magenta. And I saw that test chart and I'm like, something's wrong here. And so then I scan it through and the next one was like, because it'll generate a second chart when you're calibrating. And the next one was like all crazy pinks and stuff. And something's seriously wrong. So then I went back and one of my print heads was clogged and the photo magenta ink was not coming out.
Wow.
And so I did a cleaning and figured it all out, and away we go. And so now it's calibrated properly. But the calibration process told me that. I looked at it and I said to myself, yeah, something's not right here. It's got to be. I'm crossing my fingers and saying, please don't need to replace a printhead. Please, not right now. And the cleaning fixed it. But the Silverada from Breathing Color, that canvas, I've got a 44-inch roll of it. I'm just about to run it through the printer and do my first tests. I've got a big art show coming up next week, and I'm producing some extra canvases for it.
You will be impressed, I assure you. It's beautiful.
I hope I will be. I tried the Hanamule metallic canvas before, and I was disappointed because the print, right as soon as it would come out, it had cracks in the dark colors. And I'm like, that just seems weird. And then when I tried to put the coating on it, I know that they say you don't need to put a coating onto the metallic canvases, but I like to anyhow. All of the colors just washed away in the fluid.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, this is not going to work for me. so that test roll is garbage. And I'm hoping that the Breathing Color stuff behaves a lot better.
You know, you're printing with the same inks that I'm using. If you get any problems with it at all, then it's a problem with the process rather than the material. I mean, you could have a duff batch, but I doubt it.
Did you coat that canvas? Do you coat your metallic canvases?
I don't coat it. No, the only canvas that I coat is live. Again, from Breathing Color. But the rest of them, I don't. And they're very durable. You know, once these things have dried, you can't scratch them anyway. So I don't coat them. I'm trying to recall. There was one other thing we were talking earlier. Oh yeah, so when we were talking earlier about soft proofing, you mentioned the gamut warning, which, like you say, it shows you in red. I was going to mention a couple of things about what to do when you do get those gamut warnings.
Please do.
So there's a couple of things that I do. One is totally ignore them. because sometimes there's absolutely the difference is so subtle that the human eye can't tell the difference, and the printer actually has a pretty good chance of reproducing them so close that you can't tell. The other thing that I sometimes do is to go down into the HSL box, select the saturation, select the little the color picker thing there, drop it on the colors that are showing red, and then move it down slightly to reduce the saturation. And you can often watch the, and sometimes even increasing the saturation does the same thing. It just moves them out of the area that can't be reproduced, and you watch all of the reds disappear. That's generally what I do. But the other thing to keep in mind there is that the rendering intent that you can change it in the soft proofing mode as well. But also when you go to send the job to the printer, the rendering intent, if you use perceptual, this isn't the wording is actually a little bit weird here, but perceptual.
I'm glad you're getting into this. So what is the difference between perceptual and relative colorimetric, I think is another one?
Yeah, exactly. So they're the two that you generally use for photographic prints. So perceptual, when it has to change, when the printer driver has to move a color from something that's out of gamut to the closest color that's in gamut, if you use perceptual, it will actually move the colors close to the one that it can't print. It will move them in relation to the ones that it can print. And so it maintains the fine gradations. It moves not only the colors that it can't print, but it moves the ones that it can print to maintain the relationship. And so you've got this relationship word in your mind. But the conversely, relative colorimetric, what that does is it only moves the colors that it cannot print. And so it doesn't try to maintain the relationship between the colors that it can print and it can't print. So you can end up with some nasty gradations, some steps in there that you didn't expect. So generally, 99% of the time, you're going to want to be using perceptual as the rendering intent.
Right. And it's important to know, too, if you're doing your own printing, if we're talking about color gradations, you have the ability, if you're shooting raw, that the final files that you should be storing on your computer, I always have a master copy of my images as a TIFF file, because that's 16-bit. And what that means is, of course, you have far higher color accuracy. And I remember, this was many years ago, but I was working while in college at a print shop. And I had this wonderful picture of an island with a very slight gradation of blue in the sky, from like a light blue to an ever so slightly different kind of light blue across the sky. And I sent it out to the out lab, because we couldn't print it quite that big in store. And it came back with a bunch of jaggy lines all throughout the sky. And I'm scratching my head thinking, really? I mean, I pull up the master TIFF file on the computer again, and I look at it, and I'm not seeing that. And I send it to them. They were converting it to a JPEG, which was 8-bit.
Exactly.
And then printing it. And so I lost the color information in that sky. Yeah. And there was no way that they could have produced the print that I wanted unless I specifically went in and edited the sky to have more of a gradation or less of one. And that was not something that I wanted to do. That's at the very beginnings of when I thought, okay, well, now maybe I should take some control on the printing side of stuff and get results that I'm after. So if you are doing your own printing, or if you're going to a boutique printer that knows all of the stuff that we're talking about, they'll be able to print a 16-bit file, no problem.
That's a good point.
Yeah. And I was disappointed. I sent it back and they sent me another one that was identical. I was like, okay, well, this is not working. Something's lost in the communication here. So with these prints, and the next topic is a fun one. Once you have that on the wall, lighting is important. And I know some people go crazy with properly lighting prints or any kind of artwork on the wall. You can like have a halogen light pointed at it with barn doors that close the light in on the top and the bottom so that it's only hitting the print and makes it glow off the wall. You can do some fantastic stuff that way. And the worst case scenario is lighting it under like fluorescent lighting. Compact fluorescents are the worst. Artificial lighting comes in a lot of different qualities. And it's really important to understand how these qualities affect your work. Portrait photographers or commercial photographers, product photographers that are actually taking pictures in certain quality of light, then of course it matters to them. I'm usually doing a lot of my work outdoors, as I know you are as well, Martin. And so the quality of the light is whatever the atmosphere and environment is giving me. But when I'm showing off my prints, if the quality of light is poor, the print is going to look pretty poor there as well. Have you done any research into this?
Only a little. I know there's a few things. Like, for example, when I did my first Pixels to Pigment workshop at the X-Rite Japan office, they had a photo viewing cabinet there. Like it puts out exactly 5,000 Kelvin light. So it's like the smack in the middle of the spectrum. And they sell these. I mean, I've seen them online. They're $2,000-$3,000. A lot of those use 5,000K. I know that gallery lighting is usually 3,200, which is slightly warmer light. The other thing, of course, that you're probably thinking about here is the spectrum of light that these any given
both of these come into play at the same time.
So I mean, I know what considerations there are, and I know a lot of the common sort of thoughts around this. But honestly, in my own daily life, I have ceiling lights. I don't have a gallery. I've got photos behind me at the moment. But I just have LED lights that I can change the color of. So I can make it change from a very blue light to a very orange light with a very neutral light in the middle. So that's my answer. I don't necessarily have, I don't have one of these viewing cabinets because I don't have $3,000 to spare just to look at the photos. But yeah, I mean, I can talk about this stuff, but I haven't actually implemented very much of it at all.
So I've done some research into this, so I can carry part of this conversation forward. The human brain does weird stuff with color. I mean, we know that in so many ways because, you know, there are certain colors that our brain sees that don't actually exist. You know, one of them is magenta. In fact, that's pretty much the only real one that we make up in our heads, which is the overlap of input from both red and violet at the same time, our brain interprets that as magenta, which is interesting because then a printer has to create an invisible color, which good on you engineers for figuring all that stuff out. But the point is that we do strange things, and we'll see in an earlier podcast, I had Ray Maxwell on, and we talked a lot about color science. Mm-hmm. And if we see two different colors at the same time, our brain kind of combines them together, and we don't see those two. We see the average of them, and not really averages in the way that we think of it, but we don't see the same thing. And so if you can find out the proper mix of spectrum with giant gaps in between, we can see that as white light. And that's what compact fluorescent bulbs do. So they give us what we look at and see as white light, but it's missing about half of the color spectrum. So if you have a particular shade of orange in, you say, the picture behind you, or in a sunset picture or anything like that, and you light that with a compact fluorescent bulb, the color that should be reflecting off of the print isn't being emitted from the light source. So that color will be either darker or brighter, depending on the balance, or maybe it'll be slightly skewed. It might be a different color. And so getting good light is a huge challenge. Compact fluorescents are the worst. If anybody has them in their house and they're listening to this and those lights are hitting pictures, just get rid of them. Just replace them with LED bulbs. LEDs, and I've done some tests with this, they do give off a pretty clean spectrum.
They're very nice.
And they're getting better. It's the one area of lighting that is constantly improving. And and so you look at that and you think, okay, yeah, they're relatively energy efficient. I think they're probably the most energy efficient bulb that you can get at the moderate and high brightnesses. But the gold standard, I think, is still halogen bulbs. That's what galleries will use, and they get hot. Like the light fixture in my office is designed for halogen bulbs, but it was just getting too hot in this room. I ended up just replacing them with LEDs as a point of convenience to me.
Yeah, you know, a lot of galleries and museums are changing to LED as well now. There's a lot of white papers that they're putting together showing the price, the cost savings. You know, because if when you're talking hundreds of halogen bulbs, they're
60 to 70 watts a piece. You know,
I mean, LED bulbs are still relatively expensive, but they only use like a tenth or a 15th of the power. So
true, and because the halogen bulbs, all that energy, you know, with the same light output, I mean, that's going to heat, and so you're heating up the gallery, and then of course you've got to pay the air conditioning bill after that.
Exactly.
It seems like a whole self-defeating cycle. But it's all about the quality, right? Once the quality gets there, then the galleries are happy with it. And so when we're, you know, dealing with the whole print scenario, I was doing artwork reproductions for a painter, and I had the light set up. I had my X-Rite color checker passport to take a picture of that in front of every painting as we went. So I would have a reference to adjust the colors. I made it perfectly color balanced, and he didn't like it because... The color temperature of the lights that I was using were slightly different than the color temperature of the lights he used to paint them. And because I didn't have access to those lights, it's like, okay, well, now I just have to sit down with you and manually fine-tune the colors of these until they look like you painted them. And there was a series of around 30 paintings that we had done that way. Wow. And it was a big job, but... it just kind of goes to show me. It's like, you know, I planned this so well.
Yeah.
I tried so hard to get this as accurate as I could. But the intention of the artist always comes in at the end. Now, of course, as photographers, our intention is going to be in the editing process, the colors that we want to be producing and the colors that we maybe remembered in the scene that we're trying to recreate. So, it's a fun cycle. And it's one that I keep thinking, okay, well, how are they going to innovate this farther? What is going to be the next big thing in printing? And I heard some rumblings. I don't know if it was a patent that was applied for or an actual proof of concept product, but Canon has produced a printer that will print volumetrically, that will actually print an image but can print in depth. On a substrate, and I thought that was a really neat idea. It's like, well, 3D printing for creating a 3D object, but what if you don't want to create a 3D object? What if you want to print a texture onto an image?
Yeah, wow.
And so, yeah, it's a fun world to be in as a visual artist. Because
it's a great time, yeah.
It is. And, you know, the newer, larger printer that I bought, like a month after they announced a new version of it. So I'm right with you there. But I'm happy with what I... The only real advantage of the new one is it has that extra gloss cartridge to put that substrate on top. And so mine, unfortunately, doesn't have it. But I do a lot of canvas, so I'm putting my own coatings on it anyhow.
Well, you know, I mean, that's one good point there. Because if I could cheaply fix my IPF 6350, I'd continue using it. It's one piece of camera-related gear that I don't feel the need to upgrade with every new release, because the quality's great and the new versions. I mean, if it's still only got 12 colors, like you say, I mean, the new one's got the emulsions that to put out, but it's not going to be. I don't expect it's going to be a hell of a lot better. So you can be happy with your gear for longer than you normally would with other camera gear that keeps getting updated on relatively short cycles.
Oh yeah. You know, and I'm looking at, I'm actually quite surprised. They actually came out with a non-Ethernet version of the, IPF 8400, that is now only $3,000 US.
Wow. Yeah. And I mean, that's not a lot of money. But you know, the thing is with these, though, it's like the razor blade, the razor and the razor blade market. You know, you can buy a Gillette where you buy the razor and the first two or three blades for a couple of dollars, but then they're going to charge you a ridiculous amount for the blades every time you need to change them. And it's the same with inks. The printer manufacturers sell the printer at a relatively low cost.
You know what? At that price, for the weight and the construction of it, they're probably losing money on every printer.
It wouldn't
sale.
Surprise me. But when you consider that, and this is a fact, especially for smaller printers that have the tiny cartridges that have got like three drops of ink in them, it's actually more expensive than gold. Gram for gram, printer ink is often more expensive than gold. But the good thing about these big printers is that the cartridges are big. It cost me over $1,000 to fill this printer up, though.
Well, yeah, but how much can you print with that? I mean,
exactly.
$1,000 is going to well pay for itself if you're doing client work with all of it.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, and it is a lot more efficient. It's definitely not more expensive than gold in these big printers. But that's one other improvement of the IPF 2000 that I'm looking at, the new ones that are just coming out, because these can actually take varying size cartridges. They can take, I think mine are 360 or 320, something like that. And I think it's 360. They can take a smaller cartridge, and they can also take the 700 something milliliter cartridge.
Yeah, I've got some of the 700s. Now, for one of those cartridges, it costs me over $200, you know, times 12, but at the end of the day, I can print hundreds and hundreds of very big prints on that. And
it's much more efficient.
Now, for the smaller printers, of course, that's why there's a market for aftermarket ink cartridges. I don't think that market exists for the big guys, and I wouldn't even want to explore that because...
Me neither.
Yeah, you don't want to damage it. You just don't want to take the chance. And of course, the printer manufacturers know that, and so they got you. It's interesting though, because we're talking about, you know, print heads and replacing them and all that. A fellow photographer and printer in my area, I was sitting down for coffee with him recently, and he said, you know, I had an Epson printer, and I'm not sure if this is still the case. It was at the time. And the print head was not user serviceable, not user replaceable. You would have to get a tech to come in and replace it. But Epson in Canada, here where I am, they don't actually have a Canadian presence, so they kind of outsource the tech support, and they typically deal with like the big high volume printers, not the smaller guys. And so he was going to be waiting around for like 4 or 5 weeks before somebody could get to him to do an in-service replacement on the ink tanks. And so he just said, okay, that printer's going in the trash, and got a Canon one instead. Now, that's not to say the Canon ones aren't without problems, as we've both experienced the exact same problem on the exact same model of printer after about the exact same amount of time. That seems slightly suspicious. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like the Sony timer. There's an urban myth over here that Sony build a timer into their TVs that breaks them exactly 2 weeks after the warranty runs out. And if you extend the warranty, it knows somehow. And I've actually run into this. We had a Sony TV. I extended the warranty by 3 years, I think it was, or two, three years. So it should have been a 1 year. I paid a little extra to get a 3 year warranty, and it broke 3 years and 2 weeks after we bought it. And I kid you not, it was ridiculous. And we went back. We bought a new Sony TV last year after having a few different TVs, because I said I'd never buy another Sony. And the Sony guy in the store assured me that this is not true. And I knew, I was tongue in cheek. I was asking him about the Sony timer. But it's strange how a lot of these appliances that we buy now, I mean, TVs years ago, they used to last 20, 30 years. You know, the first few TV sets, they were chugging along for decades. And now everything, because it's printed on these tiny circuit boards and things. The technology's come a long way, and you know, we're all benefiting from that, but there's also a lot of fragility being built into them as well. You know, having something like this break after such a short time.
I have a fun thought here, and maybe you'll have some experience with it. You're a Canon shooter, right?
Yeah.
Do you have the 24-105 lens?
I used to. I sold it a number of years ago.
Okay. But, I've had that lens. After 3 years, I was shooting in Istanbul, and it fell apart on me. It just started giving me error codes, saying that it can't communicate with the camera, can't communicate with the lens. Mm. And so I looked up, there's a small little ribbon cable inside the lens that moves with the aperture assembly as you zoom the lens in and out. And in one point inside the lens, that cable gets pinched a little bit, and it'll keep working fine for about 3 years. But after 3 years of constant use, of course, outside the warranty period, it will break. And they don't just sell that cable. You have to buy the entire aperture assembly in order to do the repair. So it's a multiple $100 repair on that particular lens. Now, that's cheaper than buying the lens, so I get it repaired. 3 years later, which was 2 months ago, that lens breaks exactly the same way. It'll function at 24 millimeters, but as soon as you zoom out, it does that. And I'm like, okay, this is a design flaw. And I talked to Canon about it, and they admit no wrongdoing. There is no service notice, so you have to pay the repair bill, sir.
Exactly.
I'm like, the new version of this lens is coming out soon. It's rumored to be announced in August. And I'm thinking, do I really want to pay the bill? And I did.
Yeah.
And in 3 years, I'm going to have a broken lens again. You have to live with it.
Yeah. I didn't know that the new one was actually rumored with a time frame, but I'm waiting for the. I'm currently shooting since a few of the newer lenses came out, like the new 100 to 400. I'm currently shooting with the 11 to 24, the 24 to 72-8, and then the 100 to 400. And I'm thinking that, you know, these days I'll keep the 24 to 72-8 for the extra stop of light and the extra, you know, the shallow depth of field. But I'm really waiting for the new 24 to 105, because then I'll have no gap between 70 and 100. So I'll be able to travel with three lenses and have every millimeter covered from 11 to 400.
Of course, so I was doing trick photography along my travels. You know, I wanted to pack light, so, and like you said, bring three lenses. But I like macro photography to the extreme, so I packed in my MPE 65mm macro lens that can't do anything else but macro photography, and I packed in my fisheye lens, my 15mm fisheye lens that is great for showing those beautiful cathedral architectures, but for not much else. And then my 24 to 105, which breaks. Once that's gone, I've got nothing to, like, it was a nightmare. We find ourselves in interesting situations as photographers. We always find our way out of it. And maybe we'll have you on to talk about some more of those adventures at some point in the future, Martin. But I think this chat was great about printing. But the only thing that I might want to wrap up and say is that, you know, once you dive into printing, like once you have like tried to like create your own print, it's not the same magical feeling as it would have been in the darkroom where you just see the image come to life on the paper in front of you. That moment, I don't think the digital world of printing can reproduce. But when you hold up a well-done print in a room and it's just like beautifully lit, it is so much more powerful than it ever would have been on your computer screen. And so few photographers today are actually doing that, regardless of if they're printing it themselves. So print your work, people.
Yeah. You know, I couldn't say that any better, but I really do believe that printing is the, it's maybe not the ultimate state of the image. You know, we can do so much with our work these days, but it's incredibly fulfilling. And I think that people are missing out on a huge part of the craft and the art of photography if you don't print your work.
Right. Well, we'll leave it at that, Martin. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Not at all. Thanks for having me, Don.
I really want to thank Martin for coming on the podcast. I think the conversation was wonderful. We left off two things when I was still talking with Martin. One of them is where you can find him. So Martin Bailey is found at martinbaileyphotography.com. And you can find out all of his photographic workshops, which are fantastic, by the way. I think he's got one coming up to Namibia next year, and I'm very envious of him and everybody that's going to be on that workshop. We didn't talk about something very important too, and that was optical brightening agents in paper, OBAs, and why you should be concerned with them, with the kind of paper that you're using and how they affect the paper under different lighting conditions and over time. Maybe we'll save that for another discussion on choosing the right paper type and everything that's involved within that. I think that'd be a great follow-up talk with Martin, or maybe even get another expert on as well to cover that off. But if you like this podcast, feel free to let me know. Send me an email if you have any ideas for guests to bring on. I'm always looking for new scientific minds that are interested in photography to have a conversation with on this podcast. Thanks again for listening.